This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Last year, our guest, Dustin Hoffman, received one of America's highest accolades for artists, a Kennedy Center honor. And earlier this year, he made his directorial debut with the film Quartet, which has just been released on DVD. He's going to talk about Quartet and about his long career, which includes starring roles in such films as The Graduate, Midnight Cowboy, All the President's Men, Kramer vs. Kramer, Tootsie, Rain Man, I Heart Huckabees, and Meet the Fockers. He also starred recently in the HBO series Luck, which was set in the world of horse racing. Let's start with a scene from Quartet. It's set at a retirement home for aging opera singers and musicians. Each year, for the home's fundraising gala, the retired performers put on a show. As they're preparing for this year's gala, a new resident arrives, a long-retired opera star played by Maggie Smith. Her arrival is a shock to one of the residents, played by Tom Courtenay, who used to be her husband and is bitter about the way they parted years ago. He's been trying to avoid her. She's been trying to talk with him. When she finds him in the chapel and attempts to apologize for the past, he responds curtly, and she begins to cry.
Can't ever remember you crying.
I don't remember you being religious.
I'm not. I was trying to avoid you.
I apologize for hurting you. Please be kind. We were different people then.
You just said that, Jean. You're repeating yourself.
God. Why do we have to get old?
That's what people do.
We have to come to some arrangement.
I don't want to talk about it. You're here, I'm here, trapped.
So what are we going to do?
Grin and bear it.
What happened to forgive and forget?
Dustin Hoffman, welcome to Fresh Air. So here it is, your first outing as a director, although I think you did some directing on Straight Time. So it's a perfect opportunity to mentor young actors as you direct, and of course most of the leads are older than you are in this movie. And I mean, the actors you're directing are so exceptional. You know, Maggie Smith, Tom Courtenay, they've had long careers. So what's an example of direction you gave them?
Well, the truth is the better the actor, the less work you have to do. An important part of it is talking before you even start shooting. I didn't know Maggie. I'd met her once when I went backstage in London years ago. She had done Three Tall Women, I think it was by Albee, and she was so brilliant in it. But when I first talked to Maggie in person, I told her some of my feelings, and I said, this is kind of what I'm looking for. I said, Maggie, I said, you know, you're in your 70s, I'm in my 70s, Tom is. Billy keeps saying he's the youngest because he hasn't touched 70 yet, but Pauline Collins is. And I said, if we can put on the screen, all of us, those feelings we have now at this point in our career, you know, the ups, the downs, the fears, and now that we can see the end of the tunnel, I said, that's what I'm looking for. And she was in agreement. As a matter of fact, I did Google these actors and read every interview I could come up with. And Maggie had said in a London Times interview she gave years ago, she had been undergoing, she made no secret of it, chemotherapy and radiation. At that time, I think she was in her early 70s, and she said in the interview, that's it. She said, I don't have the energy, I don't have the drive, I don't have the passion. This has just taken everything out of me. I'm not going to act anymore. And the interviewer said, but you have your future. And she says, most of it's been. And when I quoted that to her, I said, I want that in the movie. And in fact, it is. Toward the end of the film, Pauline Collins says, you have your whole future. And she says, most of it's been. That was a feeling that I wanted her to come in with. She did quit acting then, and 2-3 years later, she started again, and she hasn't quit.
I'll say, I think she's more popular now than ever with Downton Abbey and now your film. So,
and she was going back and forth between this film and Downton Alley.
Abbey.
Call it Downtown Alley.
The American urban version.
Yes.
So working with actors in their 70s, with you being in your mid-70s, did you want to take things at a slower pace out of respect for the fact that everybody was a little older and maybe might want a little more time? And were there memory issues on the set? I mean, memory is a big issue within the movie for the characters. Was it an issue on the set?
Well, you know, there's two groups in this film. There's the principal actors, and no, there really wasn't there. And then there's the surrounding actors, which I always felt should be in the foreground. Like Fellini, I always felt took background and made them foreground. And those surrounding members were, I mean, that was the most extraordinary part of the experience, because once they agreed to let me use real singers and real musicians, Lucy Bevan, who was the casting director, scoured the UK finding these people.
Yeah, let me just explain again that yes. All the retired musicians and singers in this retirement home that's at the center of the movie, they're all real retired opera singers and musicians, a couple of them from, you know, orchestra musicians from the BBC orchestra, people who'd sung with, you know, operas in London, and a trumpeter who toured with Frank Sinatra when Sinatra toured Europe. So these are really interesting people.
Yes, and using the trumpet player, he represented everyone else that was retired. No one had rung their phone in 20, 30, at least years, and he still has his chops. So there is that extraordinary phenomena of why does the society choose at some point to make us invisible, regardless of our talent. And these people, all in their 70s, 80s, 90s, came to work every day, 6 in the morning, quite chilly, worked long hours because it was a low-budget film. They had so much passion, so much gratitude, so much energy, if you will, that they kind of were the opposite of almost what the question, you know, your question implies. I wish most actors that I worked with had so much focus and passion and clarity.
Is it ever difficult for you to find scripts that you like now? You know, in your 70s, I don't know, women are always complaining about after the age of 30 or 40, there's nothing. So has that been an issue for you as an actor?
Yes, of course it has. I mean, I was my own phenomena. Waited tables for the first 12 years, taking acting classes, and then basically the graduate I always felt was a freak accident. And I have this instant stardom, and I did start to get many scripts. I didn't like them, so I said, you know, I don't really like film that much. I'm going back to the theater. And a year later, I did read Midnight Cowboy, which was albeit a supporting part, and I did do that. But because I was this, you know, immediate star, I got all the scripts for people in my age range before anybody else did. And that was a luxury that continued through I was 29 when I did the graduate, even though I was supposed to be 21, but it continued through my 30s, 40s, somewhere in there in your 50s, if you're not holding a gun, and that I've always I've always refused to do. Then suddenly this person who was an immediate had leading roles suddenly started getting offered supporting parts. And then you get into your 60s and 70s, and those supporting parts are even less frequent. And suddenly you're being offered, lack of a better word, cameos, meaning that you die before the first act of the film is over. You have ailments.
So you've refused to hold a gun throughout your career?
Yes, I did.
That eliminates about 90% of movies.
Yes, it does. I did. I mean, there's, you know, I mean, in Little Big Man, I did, but it was for a comic effect. And in Straw Dogs, the late Sam Peckinpah, we had a disagreement on what that film was about. So I think that was the last time I wanted to use a gun, because, as you say, not only does it eliminate 90% of the films, it disallows a gratuitous element in the film, and it's very easy to make a point, you know, because the script is lacking something by just pulling a gun out.
So tell me why you refused to hold a gun.
I've just always felt passionate about the fact that that the audience is identifying in a very fraudulent way. The idea is that you bring an audience in to a film, and what you're feeling, you know, strongly about, that the audience will feel the same way. I've always trusted that. What I think is funny, they will laugh. What I think is moving will move them. What I feel is interesting, they will find interesting. I don't find anything interesting about a gun. A gun is there to threaten or kill. I've never really been on that end of it. I was on the other end of it at one point. And I have often said, I don't think people understand what it's like to have a gun pointed at you. I remember when it happened to me, I think Kennedy had just been assassinated. I was doing stock in Boston. And I remember the first thing I thought is I'm going to take a hit. And every split second, you're feeling the bullet go right through you. And you're preparing for it. You're in immediate shock. And I was aware of how easy that finger is to just touch this thing called a trigger, and it's all over. I've never forgotten that
feeling.
So
you were afraid
you
were going to be shot? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Yes, it was pointed at me, and the guy was...
Oh, and was he trying to hold you up, or what?
No, it was a guy who was part of a theater company on the producing end and did not want his wife even to have it. So, you know, I was over at the house with a character actor friend. We were just beginning the season, and he had kind of lost his bottle. And he came out and pointed this gun. I don't know much about guns, but I think it was a German Luger because the hole was so big in front. And I've never... You don't forget anything like that. A gun is rarely used in film in a way that it is feels like in life. It's simplified basically into being a cartoon experience.
Well, I enjoyed seeing you get the Kennedy Center honor. You had tears in your eyes. You were sitting, I think, right in front of the Obamas. And as, you know, Robert De Niro and Liev Schreiber and Naomi Watts, you know, spoke about your work and, you know, presented the award, you seem to really be tearing up. Do you do that easily? Do you tear up easily? Or is this just a particularly extraordinary moment for you?
Both. The older I get, the you know, my kids always say if I make a toast at the table, they say, "Dad, don't cry," you know, because it seems to get more frequent. I didn't expect it here, and I think what got me was what hit me, and it did hit me very hard is when because they don't tell you who's going to be there. I didn't even know if I was going to be the first, you know, of the four of us, but De Niro is announced. He comes out on the stage, and he starts talking about me. And I realize, oh, I guess I'm first up. And I've known him for years, and we're very good friends. I think we've always felt there's like a brotherhood between us. We just have this, you know, emotional bond. But you know, actors don't talk to each other about acting or their performances. And suddenly, in this speech he gave, what he said about me, he had never said, and it just got me. It, you know, his feelings toward me as an actor. And I called him the next day. He had actually flown out from Atlanta to Washington just to do this and then had to fly back to Atlanta to continue shooting. And I told him over the phone how deeply it hit me. And he said to me mid-conversation, "It doesn't stop." He says, "You're making me cry." And even talking about it now, that was the highest moment for me, with all due respect to the president and the first lady.
One of the things De Niro said was that the first time he met you, you were his waiter.
Yes.
That's true?
And he didn't, and you know, I've worked with him four or five different films over the years, and the last time I worked with him was one of these Fokker movies. And in the middle of a take, or at the end of a take, waiting for another setup, he comes up to me and, you know, to caricaturize Bob, he always seems to start out with, so as if he's continuing a conversation that maybe he started the day before. So you remember 1969? I said, kind of. He says, you remember, I think you were supporting McCarthy running for president. There was a restaurant. Everyone was there. It was some kind of benefit. I said, on Second Avenue? I says, yeah, kind of remember. And I'm looking at him quizzically. Why are you bringing this up now, Bob? He says, I was your waiter.
Oh, he was your waiter. Right. Okay.
Yeah. And I said, why did you just suddenly tell me this now? He says, I don't know. And then at the Kennedy Center, he expanded, and he said the first thing I ever said to him was, how's the flounder?
Right.
Which I think was a line he wrote.
So one of the things that was said at the Kennedy Center Honors about you is that you redefined the movie's idea of a leading man, which, of course, you did with The Graduate. And you expected to have a hard time as somebody who looked ethnic, Jewish, and was also short. So if you add up, like, the Jewish and the short, which was more of the obstacle early on, or did they come together to make it, you know, like...
Oh, they were all there from the start. I mean, I was a peripheral person in growing up, you know, and in junior high school and high school, and even, you know, 1 year I went to junior college, I just was considered, you know, short, unattractive, and a kind of a good, healthy case of acne on me. So that feeling about myself stuck.
If you were insecure about the way you looked, did that translate to your ability to give a good audition?
No, we didn't give a good audition for another reason. I say we, meaning I hung out with Bob Duvall and Gene Hackman. And if you're a musician, or if you're a singer or a dancer and you audition, you sing, or you you play the piano, or you perform in some way. But if you're an actor, you don't know what that character is. We study and had studied for years and years and years with these giants of acting in those days, Lee Strasberg, Sanford Meisner, Stella Adler. And there was a craft and an art to acting, and one of the conditions or the precepts is that when you first start, you don't do anything. You see what happens, and the character takes time to build, just like in painting or in writing. And so at an audition, they want the performance. And my roommate, Bob Duvall, used to see is, you know who gets these parts? He says, the people, what you see is what you get. And in other words, what they did in the audition, they wound up doing 4 weeks later when the play opened. Because they, you know, the directors and the producers, they want to see the character. And that's a kind of a contradiction to what we do, you know, for a living. We actually would take our 8x10 glossies, which you bring with you, and slip it under the door of the casting person, knock once or twice, and leave, because we just couldn't take it anymore.
Did Mike Nichols have you? I know he saw you in a play and was pretty confident he wanted you for The Graduate, but did he have you do an audition?
Yes, he wasn't confident that he wanted me. He auditioned me. I was with Catherine Ross. I think he had been looking for at least a year and a half, and we were at the end of the list. I really do believe that if we had been in the first week of people he was screen testing, we wouldn't have gotten it. I was told later that Larry Terman, the producer, when they looked at the test, which went very badly, they turned to each other, and Larry says, well, you know, that's it. There's nobody else I can think of that we can test. You know, either we go with them or we don't do it. And I think it was a resigned feeling that they go with us. And if I may say, I didn't change or alter the image of what a leading actor should look like. It was Mike Nichols. That part was written from a book by Charles Webb called The Graduate. The character Benjamin Braddock was identified in the book as being about 6 feet tall, blonde hair, blue eyed. I mean, interchangeable with Robert Redford, if you will, who also tested. And it was Mike who went against casting. And I must say that when the film was finished, I went back to New York to go back on unemployment while they were cutting the film. And when they finished cutting the film, they showed it to people who had screening rooms in their homes, Beverly Hills. And they said later, both Terman and Nichols in interviews, that people came up to them and said, what a great film you would have had if you had not miscast the lead. And that was the feeling even after it was finished.
So let me just introduce a scene from the film. The Graduate is about, you know, you've graduated college, you've come back, you're living with your parents in their suburban home, you don't have a job, you don't know what your future looks like, and you've started having an affair with the unhappy suburban woman. She is also the mother of the woman you end up marrying at the end of the movie. So you're having this affair with her that's really just all about sex, and it's kind of driven in a large way by her boredom and your young sexual appetite. So you're in bed, and you get out of bed after having sex, you turn on the light, and you basically think, maybe it's time to actually say something to each other. So here's that scene.
Look, for months, all we've done is come up here and leap into bed together.
Are you tired of it?
I'm not, no. But do you think we could liven it up with a little conversation for a change?
Well, what do you want to talk about?
Anything at all.
Do you want to tell me about some of your college experiences?
Oh, my God. Think of another topic.
How about art?
Art? That's a good subject. You started off.
You started off. I don't know anything about it.
Well, what do you want to know about it? Are you interested more in modern art or in classical art?
Neither.
You're not interested in art?
No.
Then why do you want to talk about it?
I don't.
Now, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation. Tell me what you did today.
I got up.
Oh.
I fixed breakfast for my husband.
There. There's something we could have a conversation about. Your husband.
Oh, him.
I mean everything. I don't know anything about how you work this. What do you say to him when you leave the house at night?
Nothing. He's asleep.
Always? Doesn't he wake up when you come home?
We have separate bedrooms.
Oh, I see. So you don't... I mean, I don't like to seem like I'm prying, but I guess you don't sleep together or anything.
No, we don't.
Well, how long has this been going on?
For God's sake, let's drop this.
Wait a minute. Why did you marry him?
See if you can guess.
Well, I can't.
Think real hard, Benjamin.
I can't see why you did, unless... You didn't have to marry him or anything, did you?
That's Dustin Hoffman and Anne Bancroft in a scene from The Graduate. So was it awkward for you, your first time in a movie, to be in bed with Anne Bancroft, who's already a star because of her role in The Miracle Worker?
No, it was the hardest part was to be in bed with playing a lead that was supposed to be handsome. Just getting the part. When he first called me and asked me to test, I read it and I said to him, I don't want to test. I don't think I'm right for it. I feel awkward trying to pretend that I'm anywhere near someone looking like Robert Redford. And he convinced me. And so, you know, I went into it reluctant from the beginning. And I think he felt a reluctance as we were shooting. You know, have I made a mistake? It was a huge piece of miscasting. Working with Anne Bancroft was one of the great parts of the experience because she is a great actor. Ironically, she lived on the same street as I did with Mel Brooks, and he was my idol.
I had read that you actually turned down a part in The Producers in order to do The Graduate. Is that true?
Yes. Mel Brooks gave me what I thought was going to be the start to my career because he'd seen me off Broadway, offered me a part in The Producers. I said yes, 1,000 times yes. And then I get The Graduate, and I had to call him and say, I can't do it. I got this other part. And being in bed with Anne Bancroft, it's just working, it's just making movies, was not difficult.
It's Mel Brooks' wife, Anne Bancroft.
Yes, so. And it was more difficult for him because Anne told me that he used to call up every other day because he was in New York and we were in L.A. and he would always start the conversation off with, did he kiss you yet? He was a little jealous.
So that's how you thanked him for offering you a role, turning it down and going to bed with his wife.
Yes.
Kramer versus Kramer, one of your big movies, you won an Oscar for it. you know, you're married to Meryl Streep in the beginning, and you're so obsessed with your job in an advertising agency that you're really hardly paying attention to her or your son. And she tells you that she's breaking up with you, and you don't even hear her at first. And when she walks out the door, you kind of notice what's going on, and you think she's going to come back, but she doesn't. And so you're in the position of being the single parent with your son, and you have to reshape your whole life. And it's a long series of discoveries about your son and parenthood and the meaning of work in your life and so on. So let me just play a brief scene here, and this is the famous French toast scene where it's the first morning after your wife has left and you're making French toast for your son and you have no idea how to make it. And he's kind of directing you.
Now, where's mommy keep the...
In the stove.
Okay. First thing we need is a nice hot fire.
No, you're not doing it right.
Come here. You're not doing it right. Look, you gotta do it fast, see? The rest is the rest. So the gucky part gets dissolved. Then you take the bread and we fold it. That's what we do. We fold the French toast.
I think you forgot the milk.
I didn't. Milk comes last. You always gotta put the milk in last. When you're having a good time, you forget the most important thing, right? I just want to see if you were paying attention. It's been a long time since I made this. That's fun, isn't it? When's the last time Mommy let you in the kitchen?
I don't like it when it's in pieces.
Look, French toast tastes the same whether it's in pieces or whether it's whole. I mean, bread is bread, you know? Besides, what you don't know is that French toast is always folded. You go into the best restaurants anywhere in the world, and you see folded French toast. You get more bites that way, right? You know, while that's going, Daddy's going to make a little bit of coffee for himself. You having a good time? Are you? All right, we're having a great time. I don't remember the last time I ever had such a good time. Daddy's going to make himself a little coffee.
It's too much coffee.
No. I like it strong. And Mommy always makes it too weak.
Can I have some orange juice?
Orange juice, right. Right, one of OJ coming up. What a kid.
Daddy, it's burning. It's burning.
What?
It's burning.
Oh, Jesus.
That's Dustin Hoffman in a scene from Kramer versus Kramer. You were already divorced or separated from your first wife when you made the film. You had a child. Were you relating to the character when you made it?
You know, I was actually separated, you know, which led in the midst of getting a divorce. And my first wife had brought a child into the marriage, and we had biologically our own kid. So, yes, we had two kids. And I was aware that this was the first time I was ever making a film or doing any kind of an acting job of what I was going through in life I was going to work to pretend to be doing. And people said to me at that time, you know, is it painful? Is it difficult? And I said, no, it's actually quite liberating. And I was aware then that, you know, actors aren't really creators. We're recreators of what someone else has written. And this was the first time I could feel like a creator. And the director, Bob Benton, who also wrote it, allowed me to alter things based on what I was feeling on the day. There was a great deal of improvisation. And on that scene, there was also... I might add that Justin Henry, who was so wonderful in it, first started...
He played your son, yeah.
Yes. He first started coming to work. I think he had been kind of directed, quote-unquote, by his parents the day before, days before. So he kind of was set in the way he would say things. And it wasn't like he was in life. And I said, Justin, you know, right in the first week, Justin, you don't talk like that when we talk together. Why are you acting like, quote, a kid out of some TV sitcom or something? I said, just, you know, be yourself. And Benton and I agreed that we would not tell his parents what scene we were shooting on the day, so that we would literally... find it that particular day, and we would improvise it and then narrow it down in terms of what choices we would use for the takes. But his performance, as was mine, was basically improvised, so that he didn't try to do a kid. He played himself. And we did have an emotional bond between each other, which I, you know, you really can't act that that's either exists or it doesn't.
You know, we've talked a lot about acting. You taught acting when you were in your 20s, before you were even in a movie. When you look back at what you taught when you were in your 20s, would you stand by any of that?
Yeah, because I wasn't teaching movie acting. I was teaching acting as best as I could, and it was after a few years of studying with Strasberg. So I felt I understood how to teach it. In Tootsie, there's a scene where I am teaching actors, and I improvised that scene. And basically, that was a real classroom of actors that my friend Jack Walzer, who was a teacher, I called him up the day before. I said, send over your class tomorrow morning at 6:30. I finally have been allowed to shoot this scene. And those are real actors, and I'm just doing what I did on the days I taught acting. And it's right there of what it's about. It's basically, it's don't follow the derivative. Unfortunately, it's the derivative that usually gets hired. When you have an original feeling, it's usually because you yourself are a unique person. So your questions are your questions about the character. Just as you, Miss Gross, your questions, I would bet, are your questions and not someone else telling you to ask these questions.
True.
And that's what I started with.
So you mentioned Tootsie. There's that famous scene in Tootsie where Sidney Pollack, the director of the film, is playing your agent. And you go in and you're complaining that you're not getting parts and that you sent him your roommate's play and you want to be in that play. And Sidney Pollack, your agent, hasn't done anything with it. And you're angry with him. I want to just play that scene.
Look, I don't want to argue about it, okay? I'm going to raise the $8,000 myself so I can produce his play, and I want you to send me up for anything. I don't care what it is. I will do dog commercials on television. I will do radio voiceovers.
Michael, I can't put you up for any of that.
Why not?
Because no one will hire you.
Oh, that's not true, man. I bust my ass to get a part right, and you know I do.
Yes, and you bust everybody else's ass, too. That's what you do. A guy's got 4 weeks to put on a play. You think he wants to sit and argue about whether or not Tolstoy can walk when he's dying or walk when he's talking or sing
when
he's
walking?
Oh, please,
that was 2 years ago, and that guy is an idiot.
They can't all be idiots, Michael. You argue with everybody. You've got one of the worst reputations in this town, Michael. Nobody will hire you.
Are you saying that nobody in New York will work with me?
Oh, no, that's too limiting. Nobody in Hollywood wants to work with you either. I can't even send you up for a commercial. You played a tomato for 30 seconds. They want a half a day over schedule because you wouldn't sit down.
Yes, it wasn't logical.
You were a tomato! A tomato doesn't have logic! A tomato can't move!
That's what I said! So if he can't move, how's he gonna sit down, George? I was a stand-up tomato, a juicy, sexy beefsteak tomato! Nobody does vegetables like me! I did an evening of vegetables off Broadway! I did the best tomato, the best cucumber! I did an endive salad that knocked the critics on their ass!
Michael, I'm trying to stay calm here. You are a wonderful actor.
Thank you.
But you're too much trouble. Get some therapy.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to raise $8,000, and I'm going to do Jeff's play.
Michael, you're not going to raise 25 cents. No one will hire you.
Oh, yeah?
That's Dustin Hoffman and Sidney Pollack in a scene from Tootsie. I think a lot of people have wondered, how much were you playing yourself or Sidney Pollack's vision of you in that scene? And did this reflect your working relationship at all?
Yes to all those questions is the short answer. Tootsie was originated by myself and Murray Siskel, a friend of mine at the time, which is another story, where we actually asked each other one day, you know, we all know what it feels like when we say, you know, what would it be like to be the opposite sex? But we had never asked, would our personalities be different if we were the opposite sex? And that was really the beginning of Tootsie, and we went and spent 2 years writing drafts of it. The real answer to your question is, you know, a comedy is, I think, is no different than life. There's a serious underside to comedy. And every actor that I know that saw that film saw the underside, saw the contradiction of when you study your craft for years and then when you go out and get a job, it's two different animals. The people want you to do it fast. They're not interested in you being specific. They're not interested in you, you know, going for the details, say the lines, you know, hit your mark and get off the stage or get fired. in this scene, I'm saying, but a tomato doesn't have legs. A tomato can't move. And that's exactly what we would then try to solve in acting class. And we don't just play a tomato. It's specific. A painter doesn't just paint a tomato. It's specific. What kind is it? But in film acting, everything was kind of made more general and, in a sense, less of an art form. So actors understood it on a level that no one else did. I still maintain. I mean, yes, if you were doing that scene, I don't feel any differently. Someone would say, you know, move. You say, I can't move. I'm a tomato. Tomato doesn't have legs. And then you would find a way to roll or to do something that where you couldn't use your legs. That's acting.
So did you, when you were making Tootsie and helping to write Tootsie, think a lot about who you would be if you were a woman?
Yes, that's all I did. The first thing before we started shooting, I said to Murray, I said, well, the first thing that comes to mind is I'm not a very attractive man, nor have I ever been. And if I look like this as a woman, I would have a lot of trouble. And I really felt that the men I would be attracted to would not be attracted to me. And then I mean, you make up your own backstory. Well, then I would not get married and compromise on some guy just to be married. I would probably give my life to my art. And that was the beginning of this character named Dorothy Michaels. And I saw myself as that unattractive, but, you know, nevertheless, very strongly a self-willed person.
Did it make you rethink the kind of woman you were attracted to? After thinking of yourself as an unattractive woman?
Say again.
Okay, so many men, even if they think they're not attractive, really feel this desire that they have to, you know, be a partner with a beautiful woman. And they
yes.
won't look twice at a woman who they don't think is beautiful. So yes. having played the role of a woman who isn't beautiful... Did it make you reconsider?
It hurts just to hear you say that. Still hurts. yes. I actually. Do you know that when we were doing the movie, a crew guy came up to me and I looked like a woman. It was very successful in the lighting, and you know, took almost a year to get the makeup and everything right. The idea was that if I walked down the street, I didn't want the public to think that they would turn and look and say, who's that guy in drag? I wanted to be able to fool the average person in the audience. That's what we were trying to do. And a crew member came up to me and said, I brought a friend of mine. Can I introduce him to you as your character, Dorothy Michaels, see if we can fool him? And I said, sure, go ahead. And he brought the guy over, and the guy didn't know anything about the movie. He knew that Jessica Lange was in it, and he looked me up and down in such a blunt, painful way. I felt like it was a Venetian blind. You know, he just shut the blind and looked and said, you know, where's Jessica Lange? And that happened. Guys started to do that with crew guys with their friends. And I said to my wife after a few times, I said, I cannot believe that men, and I included myself, could be that callous and in a sense erase a human being who didn't fulfill their ideas of what attractive is. And I said, and my wife said to me, I remember in that conversation, she says, what do you mean? I said, well, if I met myself at a party, I wouldn't have come up to me. And I think I'm a very interesting woman. And I got emotional at that moment.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with Dustin Hoffman, recorded in January.
When we spoke in 1999, after you had produced the film Walk on the Moon, you talked about how when you were growing up, your father was basically an atheist. He might not have described himself that way, but he was very dismissive about religion, saying it was basically a lot of hooey. But over the years, it sounds like you've gotten more, that you've identified more with religion, practiced it more. You bar mitzvahed and bat mitzvahed your children. You never were bar mitzvahed, I think.
Correct.
Well, so what changed?
My second wife. My second wife grew up in a more religious atmosphere than I did, and that's why our kids went to Hebrew school, and why they were both bar mitzvahed and bat mitzvahed, and why we celebrated holidays. I didn't even know what those holidays were, frankly. Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah, or I didn't have a clue. And I don't speak the language. I spoke a little Yiddish because my Romanian grandmother lived with us, and whenever the parents didn't want you to understand what they were talking about, they would speak Yiddish, and my mother could speak Yiddish. But yes, my father never called himself an atheist, but he just thought it was a lot of hooey, and there was no such thing as God. And consequently, I remember lying on the grass at night on my back every night, and I would talk to God, and I would ask him questions, and I would hear his answers. So I kind of made up my own God. In terms of feeling Jewish, yes, I do feel my ethnicity. I'm from Kiev, Russia, and from Yash, Romania. I love borscht. I think I understand what a Jewish humor means, and I have a penchant for vodka. I'm a Jew, I think, in my bones.
Is it gone from cultural to religious as well?
No, it hasn't. Otherwise, I probably would have got myself bar mitzvahed. I don't know if it's correct to have it or not, but I organized religion has always, I've kept a kind of a distance from, and I don't think it has anything to do with your own personal feelings. And in order to please God or to do things moral, to have a morality, in order to please God or get into heaven, I've always felt is kind of hypocritical. I think your morality is your morality, and you have it just because that's the way you want to live your life, not to get a reward. The reward is in the living itself.
So one more thing. Your father worked in movies before you were born. He was in the props department, then the head of the props department at Columbia Pictures. And you were named after the silent screen actor Dustin Farnham. I don't think I've seen him in anything.
You're too young.
Well, I've seen silent films, but I don't believe I've seen him. But right. I don't know what films he's been in. I should have looked it up, but I didn't. So did you go back and watch his film so you would know who is it I'm named after and what did he mean to my parents?
I'm ashamed to say I did not. He didn't mean anything to my parents, that I know. But now that there's the internet, I probably could.
Wait, so why did they name you after him if he didn't?
Well, they expected a girl, and my father was kind of a dogmatic guy. He said he bet people that I would be born on his birthday and it would be a girl. I was born on his birthday, but I wasn't born as a girl. My mother, we were lower middle class. My mother was in a place called Los Angeles Hospital, and she had a room with other people. And every day they would come in and say, "You have to name your son." And they couldn't get around to picking a name. And one morning, they said, "We need it now." And there was a magazine on the next bed. The woman was reading a movie magazine, and there was the name Dustin Farnham, and she picked Dustin.
Wow.
And and that was it. And he was a cowboy actor. He was a silent movie cowboy actor. And he and his brother, William Farnham, and before that, I think they were Shakespearean actors. But now I will try to take up. I've seen photos of them. But I'll tell you what's one of the great perks about having a successful career is the number of people I now see and hear that are named Dustin.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, particularly athletes.
And they're all named after Dustin Farnham. They don't want to tell you that.
You're right. You're right.
Well, Dustin Hoffman, I want to thank you so much for talking with us again, and thank you for your movies.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Grove. May I just say that...
Can you just call me Terry?
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Dustin Hoffman speaking to Terry Gross. He directed the film Quartet, which is now out on DVD. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter @NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr @nprfreshair.tumblr.com.